Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Because of our position in the world, other countries must always react to the outcome of our presidential elections. But this last election has many world leaders scrambling to calculate what it will mean to them, their nations, and the world order, because Donald Trump is a different kind of American president. If his last term is any indication, his transactional approach to conducting world affairs puts international norms into turmoil. His attitude toward NATO and traditional alliances that have kept the world safe since the end of World War II also threatened to destabilize world powers, and his threat to use tariffs could upend the world economy, not to mention your personal economy. Trump has said he would end the war in Ukraine on day one. He has said the war in Gaza would end prior to his taking office by virtue of his victory. And his relationship to dictators, along with his admiration of their tactics, is unlike any president in our history. Trump likes to keep everyone guessing about what he might or might not do, and that makes for dicey relationships and an appearance of America being an unreliable partner. So this hour, the impact of Donald Trump and his America First ideology. We're joined by Peter Feaver. He's professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. Cherno Cham is back with us. He was here on election night. He is provost and chief academic officer and professor of political science at Johnson C. Smith University. And Ella Nickmeyer joins us briefly. She's foreign policy and security reporter for the Associated Press. Good morning to you all. Thank you for being with us. I appreciate it. I'm going to get to Ellen very quickly in this conversation because she has a real job to go to. But let me first start with a question for Peter. How would you describe, Peter, the international relations between the United States and other countries during the first Trump administration?
Well, Trump inherited a world that was, in 2017, that was far more stable and far more resilient than the world he's inheriting in 2025. Ironically, he has a pretty severe critique of Biden's foreign policy record, and I think many of those critiques landed. But it means that the job he's facing is much more difficult. And I think he and his team may not be aware of just how challenging it's going to be, because what they offered in the campaign was simplistic nostrums rather than serious proposals. So if he goes by how good he had it in the first term, that may not be a good predictor for him on how it'll go for him in the second term.
Cherno, if you agree with that, that the world is more dicey or dangerous than it was in the first Trump administration, we do have the war in Ukraine. We do have the conflict going on now between Israel and Hamas, both in Lebanon and in Gaza. We have other conflicts brewing around the world and China saber rattling in Asia. Do you agree that the world is perhaps a little more dangerous? And where would you lay the blame for that? Can we lay it at the feet of President Biden, or is it simply what happens in the world at large?
Without question, I agree.
Here on behalf of the United States.
Go ahead.
Without question, I agree. One of the most persistent characteristics, actually, of U.S. foreign policy since 2016, the first ascent of Donald Trump to now, can be characterized as America's withdrawal from the global scene, its abdication of its global responsibility for a system that it actually built, meaning the system we live in, and we can talk about it in details later, which is known as the liberal international order, a rules-based system, a system based on openness of commerce, openness of exchange of ideas, and a world basically led by the United States. But Trump withdrawal was also accentuated in a sense by Biden's withdrawal from the international system. And that in the midst of that vacuum, we are witnessing right now the chaos that we see around the world.
Ellen, world leaders all congratulated Donald Trump. That's the custom on his comeback. That happens every 4 years. But what are world leaders saying behind the scenes in their own capitals? What are their primary concerns about Trump 2.0?
There's concern among world leaders about whether existing U.S. alliances with with world organizations and within individual countries will stay the same. Trump President-elect Trump has not shown the same emphasis on portraying the United States as the leader of the world's democracies and the protector of world democracies as past US presidents does. So when I talk to diplomats, there's urgent discussions about evaluating their own security arrangements and in particular their own defense arrangements and looking to strengthen regional alliances in their own defense. There's a sense that the US won't be as dependable to its usual allies.
Is this philosophy of going it alone, of America first, is it something he truly believes, do you think? Is he being fed this by other people who surround him? Does he not understand the vital role that America has played since the end of World War I, actually, but really World War II? Does he not understand that?
President-elect Trump has had a more transactional view of U.S. relationships with other countries. He's a frequent topic of his is wanting allies to pay their way. He's said that repeatedly about European allies and NATO. He's forged strong relationship with wealthier Gulf countries who have more money to bring to the table when it comes to things like defense alliances. Some of his aides, his previous aides, they dispute the idea that he's isolationist. They point to his close support for Israel. They point to his concern about the Iran nuclear program as showing that he's not an isolationist. He just has narrower priorities and different priorities.
I want to come back to that idea of whether or not he's isolationist in a second. But Peter, I know you want to get into this, but you have also referred to the president-elect as nakedly transactional.
So President Trump, like every president since Roosevelt, has been frustrated by the allies and feels like the allies haven't done enough and take advantage of America. So every president since NATO was formed browbeat our NATO allies to spend more on defense. What makes Trump different is every other president said, on balance, the allies were worth more positive for all the hassle that they imposed on us on a negative way, and that it was better for American national interests to be the public goods provider who carried a disproportionate amount of the load, because in the long run, that was better for American national interest. Trump is different. He believes it's not better in the long run. And so he homes in narrowly on the transactional question of, are the allies spending as much as they should? Every president would say no, but every other president would say, no, they're not, but we should still stick with them. And President Trump says, no, they're not, and therefore we should leave them to their own devices.
This is not the first time that people have advocated America first. He's just the one in a string of politicians. But this is a different post-World War II attitude, because it used to be that we're all in this together. But does it make it, Cherno, does it make it necessarily the wrong approach? Does it make it dangerous? Does it make it unworkable? Or is it simply different?
When you look at American foreign policy from a historical perspective, you can always see the tension between the two. Back in the days of the framers, you could see the debate, right? Four fundamental voices with two fundamental trains of thought, of schools of thought. Are we going to put America's interests first, or are we going to put values first? So that brings us to the debate between the realists and the liberals. And also the realists, meaning basically, are we going to take an America first approach, meaning what? Are we going to be isolationist, or are we going to do a politics of values, meaning we are ready to actually take our values out to the world, to democratize, to spread the good that is associated with freedom? So that is actually a trend that continues. But when you look at Trump's policy, though, it is just fundamentally different from what we have seen in history, because with history, you've seen a debate, a robust debate, going from the debate from Hamilton to Jefferson, right? Whether we should isolate, keep our house together first, or whether we should engage. But with Trump, fundamentally, you look at it from 2016 to now, it is a foreign policy that lacks strategy, that is impulsive, that is reckless, and that is quite frankly unplanned. And that's what we have to call it when we scratch beneath the surface.
Let's get back to the idea of whether or not he's truly an isolationist. I know, Ellen, you just wrote about this recently, and you quoted in that article Victoria Coates, who is a security advisor to Trump in his first term, who said on a recent podcast that she believes he is, quote, extremely judicious about the application of the American military and about potentially getting embroiled in conflicts we cannot resolve. And she also rejects that idea that he is isolationist. If that's the case, then what is likely to be our approach to Israel? What is likely to be our approach to Ukraine beginning on January 20th, or for that matter, Taiwan, as we go forward?
Right. I mean, another argument for those who say he's not an isolationist is he does have a closer relationship than usual with Russia. And there's a difference between being isolationist and seeking out, you know, different partners or allies or consultants. So he, some of his references to Ukraine very much have echoed positions that Russia has stated. So there is that. And he has, in his first term, he certainly reached out to foreign leaders who he admired as strong. That includes Putin, and you know, that includes North Korea's leader, trying to see if, you know, there he could establish a personal bond that influenced him. Those aren't the hallmarks of an isolationist.
Well, the question also is he isolationist selectively? In other words, he is transactional. So when we say he is he transactional because he's trying to get the best, quote unquote, deal for the United States or the best deal for himself, whether it's monetary or whether it's flattery or ego enlargement? Is if he likes you or you like him, then would he likely be less isolationist toward you, Ellen?
Right. I will say that, you know, people, his supporters and his critics say he's a businessman. So he's looking for immediate gain, either for, you know, for whoever. And in with regard to Ukraine, foreign governments have come to like stress the value of arms deals for Ukraine, arms support to Ukraine, to the U.S. defense industry. They point to how local communities with defense plants benefit from jobs and money when the U.S. gives aid to Ukraine to buy arms. And in that sense, that's a sign of, you know, allies trying to kind of reconfigure their arguments to approach him on the level that they think he pays attention to.
Ellen Nickmeyer is a journalist for the Associated Press. She covers foreign policy, national security, and climate. I wish we had time to talk about climate, because our approach to climate change is likely to change dramatically in the next 4 years, given what he did in his first term, President Trump did in his first term. But we have to let Ellen go, because she has a real job to go to. And so thank you for joining us, Ellen. We really appreciate your help and your expertise. When we come back, more with Peter Fever from Duke University, author of Thanks for Your Service, The Causes and Consequences of Public Confidence in the U.S. Military, and Cherno Cham from Johnson C. Smith University. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about international reaction and international relations in a Trump 2.0 administration with Peter Fever, professor of political science and public policy at Duke University, and Cherno Cham, professor of political science and provost at Johnson C. Smith University. Off the air, Peter wanted to point out that although I said goodbye to Ellen Nickmeyer from the AP saying she had a real job to go to, both of these gentlemen have real jobs. Let's not be academic about this, which is more crucial, Cherno, to maintaining peace and stability over the course of the next 4 years. The decisions that Donald Trump makes about foreign policy and foreign relations in these next 4 years, or other world leaders' reactions to those decisions?
Both in the sense that American leadership will matter in ways that it has mattered not before, because as we have agreed today, we happen to live in a world that is far more dangerous than when Trump took the reins of office the first time around. And for that, the policy that the Trump administration will have to put in place will have to be policies that are planned, will have policies that are strategic, and not just transactional. Helen, before leaving, was talking about the idea that with Trump, flattery will get you long ways, and also friendships at the emotional level will get you long ways. And I just have to remind people that when Trump first took office, we remember that, and I think that was one of the most salient aspects of his foreign policy as a president, when he decided all of a sudden to withdraw troops from Syria. And at the same time, but those troops in Syria were preventing Iran from being the dominant power it is seeking to be, was serving as a buffer zone pretty much. And at the same time, committing 3,000 troops to Saudi Arabia. And when asked, he said, because Saudi Arabia pays good money for what we are doing. That's not foreign policy. The state and politics is far more than a business. It's a trust. It's a trust that the international community has placed in the hands of the American
presidents. Let me get your take on that, Peter, because a lot of Americans voted for Donald Trump the first time and maybe the second time because he is a businessman, despite having gone in bankrupt 6 or 7 times and leaving people in the lurch as a result. He is a businessman, and they want a more business approach to government. Is that possible? These are two different kinds of entities, government and business. Can you take a business approach domestically and or internationally and be successful?
There's no question that government needs to be reformed and that there are some insights from complex business operations that might be applied usefully to, say, the foreign policy establishment or national security establishment, particularly DOD. But it's a business unlike any other in private sector. For one thing, there's 535 members of the Board of Trust of Governors, namely the Congress, that votes the budget, and that complicates planning enormously. And so even very experienced business leaders, say Rex Tillerson in the first term, struggled when he came from Exxon to the State Department and realized, wow, it's just so much more complex than he thought. So that's the first point. The second point is folks like you mentioned Victoria Coates, and she had a fair point that President Trump didn't use force willy-nilly in the first term. But that's because he was talked out of some bad ideas by members of the national security team that he had picked, who were willing to stand up and say, you know, uncomfortable truths to him. Who will be the truth tellers in Trump 2.0? And so far, he has indicated that he prefers loyalty to people with independent stature who might speak the truth to him. And the third point I think that needs to be mentioned is, yes, President Trump has literally written the book on how to make a deal. But when in government, the deals that he sought have tended to be very short term, with short term benefits that trade off long term positive consequences in exchange for a short term symbolic, sometimes in monetary benefit. Remember the deal he almost struck with Xi Jinping in January or February of 2020, just as the COVID virus was spreading, and we now know that China was lying to us and the WHO, about it. So getting tough on China was needed. he was letting up on Xi Jinping because Xi Jinping was offering a side deal on soybeans, a very short-term bilateral 1 year benefit that President Trump was chasing for election reasons. And so I think the record is that he's not all that successful as a deal maker. I'll just leave with this. If I were the Iranians, I would start negotiating with him now, because I think he would be chasing a deal with the Iranians, and they're in such a bad position otherwise, the Iranians, that they might be able to get a better deal out of Trump than what is otherwise coming their way. So that it's not as if there's no deals to be had under Trump 2.0, but it's a way more complicated picture than probably the folks who are listening to you and voted for Trump expect it to be.
One small correction. He did not write The Art of the Deal. It was ghostwritten for him. Donald Trump.
I stand corrected.
That's okay. Donald Trump likes strong men. He likes leaders who operate out of fear. He seems to believe that America will be safer if the rest of the world fears us, or at least fears him, or both, through his unpredictability and his actions. Cherno, is he right? Does the world fear a second Trump presidency? And if so, is that a good thing, to quote Martha Stewart?
It is not a good thing. Because a good thing for American foreign policy would be engagement, or re-engagement rather, re-engagement based on a planned strategy, re-engagement based on America knowing what it wants out of the deal, if I can use that term, going into it, to be strategic about the deal. You know, the greatest irony is when you look at actually American policy over these past 75 years, since the emergence of what I would call the American-led liberal order, has been that whether it doesn't matter if it is a Republican administration or a liberal administration, they've always been a continuum where the world knows that they can count in a very predictable way, because predictability in foreign policy is not all that bad, because you hear a lot of people talk about strategic ambiguity. But with Trump, it's less of a strategic ambiguity than of an impulse buy. So what this administration needs to do, and I really wish success with this administration, because its success is also the success of the American people, is that the US makes in very strategic ways the decision, where do we want to be over the next 10 years? Where do we want to be over the next 50 years? Take, for instance, Kissinger, with all of his failings. When you look at today, China's rise, when you look at today, what Russia and China have done, Kissinger was actually very strategic in making sure that the Soviet Union never gets in a close relationship with China. When he actually embarked on his China deal, a lot of people were criticizing it. But looking back to it, he actually prevented, his actions led to the dismantling of the Soviet Union. So we give credit to Ronald Reagan, but we have to be fair and go back to look at the strategy of American foreign policymakers and what they did there. And I think that was something that was worth applauding. But with Trump, we have the impression that it's the other way around.
Operating, Peter, on the world stage requires information. It requires strategy. It requires formulating that strategy based on things that we know, or information that we have gleaned from various sources. And from 2005 to 2007, you served as special advisor for strategic planning and institutional reform on the National Security Council at the White House. You had previously served as director for defense policy and arms control there. Our own intelligence forces, the last time around, were concerned about how Trump treated classified information during and after his term was over. They were concerned that other nations will be, or were becoming, or were in fact reluctant to give key information, to share that information with us, because they didn't know what Trump might do with it. Can a president be effective if other nations, if our own security apparatus, is reluctant to keep him informed?
This is a big concern. The best way to think about the executive branch is that it's a vast information funnel, everyone trying to push information up and get it in front of the president. That's the way it normally operates. And the job of the staff around the president is to winnow that down so that he or she will only see the information that they most need to see. They won't be swamped with less important information. But if he's being systematically misled by information withheld from him because of concerns about how he'll treat it, then that will undermine his effectiveness as a decision maker. And so reassuring the team that he can be trusted is, I think, in his own interest. And that's why it was somewhat surprising to me that he signaled early on, or the people around him signaled, this is about 2 weeks ago, or even before the election, that they were going to jettison the FBI's vetting process and rely on private vetting in order to grant security clearances. This would greatly expand the freedom the president had as to who could get a security clearance. This would be legal. The president can do this if he chooses to do so. But the effect that would have is actually bringing in more people that are not trusted by the rest of the establishment. And so that's a real challenge for him. And I think they will want to reconsider that if they're still thinking about it.
Well, for instance, Elon Musk has a top secret security clearance, I suppose, because of his work with SpaceX, which supplies rockets and vehicles to NASA. But he also has conversations with Vladimir Putin. If you have somebody that like that cozying up to the president, and he's been positioned perhaps as a shadow president coming up in the next 4 years, how dangerous is that? And how dangerous is it if people within the security apparatus and within the military, who have already spoken out against him, don't trust him, don't like him, and don't think he can be... He can be trusted with our secrets, essentially.
Well, let me clarify something I said in case I don't want the readers to misunderstand it. There's not a deep state that's out to thwart the president. Quite the contrary. The civil service and the uniformed military will obey all lawful orders from the president, and they are standing by to help him be the most effective commander-in-chief he can be. But trust is the universal solvent in that relationship, which is already complex with lots of countervailing pressures. And so, as you say, when you bring in people who are not trusted or are not trustworthy, then you are drawing down on reservoirs of trust, things that you'll need when the very trust you'll need when things go sideways. So I do think the administration needs to be very careful about the using as the mantra, well, let's disrupt, let's break the system, and then we'll build something better. Breaking the system will, at a time when the country is facing very serious threats, will have quite negative consequences, I believe.
I know the Cherno wants to get on this, but I have to follow up on what you just said. What if they don't? I mean, what if that's what they want to go in and they want to break things? That's what they want to do. That's what they were, in fact, elected to do in many people's minds. So if that's their approach, what then?
Well, I think they'll be hobbling their own decision-making effectiveness. And they'll be making themselves vulnerable to foreign adversaries who will see opportunities to exploit. And they'll be making their allies less effective partners because they'll be undermining the trust that the allies have. And so it's a tempting, performative, stick it to the man kind of move, but it's literally cutting off your, not literally, it's figuratively cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Cherno.
I think Peter has taken that point actually away. And for me, and that is the big worry, also that really animates the American foreign policy experts, that you're almost going to have a match between what you would consider to be major league versus minor league, where basically you have Russia playing a chess game and America playing a checkerboard. And the danger, the real danger would be now putting those people who lack the experience and who lack the security clearance, they stand to expose themselves to potential blackmail and end up revealing information that would be damaging to the national security of this country in ways in which actually Trump may not even intend it.
Our previous guest, Ellen Nickmeyer, who writes for the AP about world affairs, recently wrote an article titled, "The Leader of the Free World Has Never Been a Role Trump Has Embraced, the world has gotten the message. And she says in that article that European leaders are calling for a new era of self-reliance, not dependent on American goodwill. Some in this country, maybe Donald Trump, thinks that's not a bad idea. They should rely on themselves and leave us out of it. It's Europe. They're 3,000 miles away. Is it wise, Cherno, or does it create cracks in world relationships and weaken America on the world stage?
But this is the whole problem, because remember, America has spent the time since World War II building a world order that has primarily benefited America. And that has, by and large, benefited the world, because we have lived through a stretch of time that's been more peaceful than at any time in U.S. history or in world history. So now to just jettison it in the water out of misunderstanding, I think is a big mistake, because the world as it is right now, if America decides to withdraw, what will you have in place? You will have the rise of authoritarian regimes. You will have the rise of insecurity. And I say, right now, we're dealing with challenges that are so significant, the likes of which we've never seen as a human society, that this is the wrong time for America to withdraw. Not only on the security perspective, but even when you look at the major and the most significant challenge we are faced with, climate change. And it is incidental that the world is meeting today. How can we address it without U.S. leadership, with the U.S. being the dominant power on planet Earth?
Peter?
Well, I agree with President Trump that our European allies need to do more and our Asian allies need to do more. I think it's magical realism to think that just abandoning them will cause them to do more. And the part that is most magical in his thinking is that we can somehow better confront China by surrendering or retreating in Europe, that abandoning Ukraine will somehow strengthen the defense of Taiwan. There are people around President Trump who argue that, and that's magical thinking in my judgment. And ironically, if you follow the logic that President Trump has applied with respect to our NATO allies, it applies to Taiwan. He's called on Taiwan to triple its defense spending up to 10%, and if they don't, 10% of GDP, and if they don't, he says they're not worth defending. So he's even talking about perhaps abandoning Taiwan to China. How is that going to meet the Chinese threat?
When we come back, I want to talk about the United States' position in the world. It's not just our military might that makes us the world leader. It is our moral leadership. It is our expectations of behavior that we set for the rest of the world. And I want to talk about putting that in jeopardy with this second Trump administration when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Peter Fever is with us, professor of political science and public policy at Duke University and author of Thanks for Your Service, The Causes and Consequences of Public Confidence in the U.S. Military. Cherno Cham is also here. He's the provost at Johnson C. Smith University, where he is also a professor of political science. And we're talking about the world order under Trump 2.0. The United States, Peter, has set the tone for the world, on the world stage for nearly a century. Our leadership and our expectations have led the way among Western democracies. We have defined the West, what's expected of us, how we act, our moral position in the world, and made a clear distinction between the United States and our Western allies and the rest of the world, those on the other side of the equation, communists, dictators, authoritarians, etc. What will it mean if these lines begin to blur, Peter?
Well, I used to say that President Trump 1.0 was the bell that could not be unrung, that having elected someone like that, such an unusual candidate, our allies had deep questions about American power and the responsibility with which American power would be wielded. Re-electing him is the gray rhino that cannot be avoided, right? You could see it coming for a long time, but it's going to have very dramatic impact. And I think it's going to change for the rest of our lives the way the rest of the world views American power. The rest of the world always had doubts about American wisdom, and but the doubts tended to be of the sort that Churchill offered, where he said you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they'd exhausted all the alternatives. Now there's some doubt as to whether they will do that. Let's be clear. President Trump did care about certain soft power issues, or at least his administration did. They leaned into, say, religious freedom issues in the first term. And so it's possible that that will return. That was more Secretary Pompeo's point of emphasis, though. So it's unclear whether there's somebody in the new Trump administration that will care about religious freedom as much as they did in the first term. I think they'll also care about hostage negotiations. There's a couple, one or two items like that, where I think you'll see Trump trying to score sort of human values type points. But more generally, the kind of rhetoric that President Biden offered, and before him, the previous presidents, about America as a beacon of freedom, I don't think you're going to see so much of that in the second Trump term.
Chairman?
Let's put it in context. American values. To be fair, America, and we know it through history, was not the first great power. But America was the first great power based on values. I still recall in the middle of World War II, when Roosevelt met with his confidant, Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada. During that meeting, actually, if you look at the record, if you look at the transcripts, Roosevelt was already laying out his vision, what the world will be after this great tragedy. And in that, he said, my world and the world that America will lead will be a world based on the values of freedom, of democracy, but also of decolonization around the world. And this is actually the hallmark of American power. It is just not a power based on military domination. It is a power that the world wants to emulate, and we cannot lose it. And there's a reason why anybody who escapes anywhere from around the world, their first ideal destination is America. And this has made the U.S. one of the greatest powers on earth, because that's where you have the most intelligent, capable people coming to this country to contribute out of that ideal of democracy, knowing that their freedoms will be valued. If we lose that, then we lose what Rome was. We lose what the powers before America was.
Peter, pundits have said that we have this election ends the Roosevelt coalition. It ends the whole program that Roosevelt set up. And if he set up a world in which we supported and encouraged democracy, we have a leader now who sidles up to dictators. He admires strong men. If he's to be believed, he would like to be one himself, and he certainly positions himself as one. So you've got Putin and Netanyahu and others who are probably looking forward to the next 4 years. On the other hand, the last time around, Donald Trump was critical of, even threatening toward, NATO. If that continues, if he pulls out of NATO or refuses to defend the NATO nation when required to, that the whole paradigm has changed. What does the world look like in a situation where NATO is without the United States?
Well, NATO is a lot stronger in 2024 than it was in 2016. So that is one difference. That's a positive difference. The addition of Sweden and Finland, those are significant NATO assets. That is something that, if President Trump squanders, will be a bigger loss than would otherwise be the case. At the same time, though, inside European politics, the countries are weaker. So Germany's weaker, France is weaker, Britain is weaker. And so their ability to step up and fill a power vacuum if the U.S. leaves is more limited. And frankly, Trump can hollow out NATO all on his own without any legislative action. All of the steps that he would need to do to weaken NATO fall well within his Article II powers.
And what would his motivation be for wanting to weaken NATO?
Well, there's the one that you raise as a speculation. I'm not sure I would camp there, but it's out there as a speculation. Is he doing this to help Putin because he's fond of Putin? That would be the most extreme negative interpretation. I think a more likely explanation is that he believes that the Europeans have taken advantage of us for 75 years and it's time for them to pay up. And he just believes it, and there's nothing you can say to shift him of it. And it is absolutely the case that Europe did free ride on the United States. So they could have done more. Even today, they could, in theory, do more, although their politics will make it hard to do it. But, and this is the point I tried to make before, I think there's some in his team who think this is a clever strategic move to reorient and refocus on Asia, because the one set of hawks that he has brought in is China hawks into his Trump 2.0 administration. These are people who view China as a real threat and that's the future challenge, and Europe represents an old challenge. Let Europe deal with Russia. We will deal with China.
Are they wrong?
They're right that China represents a bigger challenge than Russia does, but I think they're wrong in thinking that the way you confront China is to abandon Ukraine. I think the way you confront China is to leverage our global alliance rather than to divide our alliances. And so I call that kind of thinking, that we can divide our alliances and yet be stronger with respect to China. I call that magical realism. It sounds realistic and practical, and I'm going to make tough choices, but its net effect will be to weaken the U.S. vis-a-vis China.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about something that will have both domestic and international consequences, and that is Donald Trump's approach to taxation, particularly when it comes to tariffs. It was positioned by Donald Trump on the campaign trail that tariffs would be the end-all, be-all. It would cause more American businesses to relocate in the United States because we were going to charge big bucks for things coming in from out of the country. But it was positioned as something that would save American taxpayers money, when in fact tariffs are taxes, and the taxes are paid ultimately by consumers. If you want to buy a smartphone that was made in China, once these tariffs kick in, they're going to charge tariffs on these smartphones. And the company selling them will simply pass those costs on to you, the consumer who wants to buy that. What impact is this likely to have on the world economy, on the United States economy, if he does this, Peter?
Well, this is one of the great ironies, is that the folks that made the heart of the Trump coalition, sort of folks without a college education, folks who didn't have high paying jobs like NPR hosts, they they will end up carrying the burden of the Trump tax, the tariffs, because it will affect their consumption, which is a higher fraction of their domestic budget. And so they're the ones who will face the tax burden. Now, ironically, the U.S. does probably need to take in more revenues because the deficits have ballooned. They ballooned under President Trump the first term, and then they got even greater under President Biden. And so more tax revenues have to come in. Ironically, President Trump is saying that he will draw that tax revenue from his base. So the question is, how long will he be able to do that before his base says, wait a second, you promised us that you would fight inflation and you've got to do something else? I think the tariffs may be a short run thing for him, even though his love for tariffs is a long run thing. He's had decades of embrace of tariffs. This is not a recent policy innovation that he's caught into.
Cherno, two of your areas of expertise are Latin America and Africa. Wired reported this week, Wired magazine, that Trump officials in the first term took an aggressive stance in Latin America to discourage trade ties with China. And during his first term, Trump referred to some nations in Africa as S-hole countries. Let's put it that way. What has been the reaction to leaders in those parts of the world to this election?
The reaction has been, as you can come to imagine, one of, well, I wouldn't say disbelief because they already had an idea who Trump was the first time he was running, but one of outrage. And then as you can see also in foreign policy, the one thing Trump forgets is speeches are policy. And as a result, that's why today you're not going to be surprised to see whole parts of Latin America moving away from the US to realign, and whole host of African countries moving away to realign both with China and with Russia. Matter of fact, one of the most salient developments, as you are aware, was on September 16, 23, when three breakaway African countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, decided that they were going to align their policies with that of Russia and that they were not going to toe the Western line anymore. But you could just see it as an isolationist act or an act of isolation. But when you look at the whole host of African countries, the area, whether you're talking about Central African Republic right now, who are being sponsored by Russia, even South Africa right now, who in the United Nations actually aligns more with Russia than it does with the US, you can begin to see that Trump's rhetoric is playing a big, significant and substantive role in realigning those countries.
And we've already talked, and you brought this up, Cherno, that the world is a more dangerous place today than it was during the first Trump administration for various different reasons. This sounds to me like this approach will make it even more so. Will it?
Absolutely, without question.
Mike, can I just make one observation here?
Sure.
And that is, we're forgetting that President Biden is still president for 2 months. And so the areas that Tierno just described, those are regions that are unstable right now. Haiti right now, Cuba right now. Those crises could happen on Biden's watch, not on Trump's watch. And so folks need to be recognize when we say the world is a dangerous place, we're not talking in theory. We're talking in day-to-day reality.
Absolutely. And the world is even more dangerous in times of American transitions, if you notice, right? Today, as you notice, between Russia and Ukraine even, they're both escalating with the notion that they do not know what to expect of the Trump presidency. And the escalation should have been actually predicted because each one of them is putting themselves in a great footing so that when the bargaining comes, they are in a great position to bargain for themselves. And across the African region, you're having the same dynamics too.
Peter, Nick Schifrin, writing for PBS NewsHour, says an Israeli official recently told him that Benjamin Netanyahu knows Donald Trump wants to win a Nobel Peace Prize and that Netanyahu may try to help him by offering a gesture on Inauguration Day. If that is true, it could be anything, I suppose, but it could also be a sign of a kind of relationship the two are likely to have going forward. And if that's what it is that a good sign?
Well, I'd like to see what the gesture would be. I think the prospects for peace are more remote today in on the Israel-Palestine issue than they've been for some time. And I think we need to see new Palestinian leadership and perhaps new leadership in Israel before you could have genuine prospects for peace. I think there's more likely that President Trump will chase his Nobel Peace Prize in Kiev. And so look for some kind of big deal that will end the fighting in Ukraine and argue that that's how he brought peace in our time.
Cherno.
I am a liberal, therefore I believe anybody can be transformed, but I'm not holding my breath. And the reason is when you look at Israel and Palestine, the dominant feature from 1948 to now, it has been that Israel has always wanted a process without outcome, and Palestine has always wanted an outcome without a process. For that reason, those two are not reconcilable. And that's why if you look at Qatar, who is actually mediating the conflict between the two now, has thrown the towel out of, because Qatar is saying, I do not believe that any party is motivated by good faith. So then what would the gist of Benjamin Netanyahu be? That's what I will waiting to that's what I'll be waiting for.
I have less than a minute left. Just quick answers from both of you. If no major disaster results from a new Trump presidency, what will the impact be of an America that turns inward at the expense of traditional leadership roles that we've played in the world? Who is likely to fill the vacuum? Peter.
I think you'll see China filling the vacuum if America turns inward.
Cherno?
And I do not want to see a world led by China and Russia, because both will try to fill in that vacuum. International relations doesn't deal well with vacuums.
Cherno Cham is provost at Johnson C. Smith University, professor of political science there. Peter Fever also with us, a professor of political science and public policy at Duke University and author of Thanks for Your Service, The Causes and Consequences of Public Confidence in the U.S. Military. And in the first segment, we also were joined by Ellen Nickmeyer, reporter for the Associated Press. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.